Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we've been watching, reading, and listening to. On this week's show, I am just back from the Toronto International Film Festival, along with NPR's film critic Bob Mondello. So Bob and I will run down some of the movies we saw, both big and small, ones you've heard of and ones you may not have, and maybe you'll even get a jump on awards season. Then, as fall TV kicks in, we'll return to a tradition we've come to treasure and dread, our fall TV pool. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. So stick around.
I know you love listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour, so I think you should also check out the first episode of NPR's new Hidden Brain podcast. Shankar Vedantam explores a conversational phenomenon called switch tracking, when two people think they're talking about the same thing, but in reality are speeding down separate tracks. It usually doesn't end well. The Hidden Brain podcast is out now. Subscribe on the NPR One app, iTunes, or npr.org/podcasts, and don't miss an episode.
It's fall movies and fall TV on tap this week, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And joining us this week, our pal Bob Mondello. Bob, what do you do at NPR?
I see way too many movies in 1 week.
Yeah.
We just proved.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. Well, Bob and I are just back from Toronto. I missed you guys very much while I wasn't here, but Bob and I were off wildly seeing movies in Toronto. They show literally hundreds up there. I saw 25. Bob saw
32.
Because he is able to stay out longer than I am.
But what Linda knows about me is that sometimes I don't see all of a movie.
Uh-huh.
Partly because I skip out of a couple of them when they're really dreadful, which there were a couple of those this time.
And I didn't count any that I did that with.
Right. And I have been known to close my eyes briefly and open them a good deal later.
To concentrate.
Wow.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But we're only, I'm sure that Bob will only talk in detail about the ones that he actually saw all of and remained awake for.
That's fair.
So don't worry about that. I want to start with one that Bob and I both saw that we've talked about on this show before a couple of times, which is The Martian.
Wow.
Starring Matt Damon in an adaptation of the Andy Weir novel. The adaptation was done by Drew Goddard, who worked for Buffy and did Cabin in the Woods and lots of good things. And it's directed by Ridley Scott, who, you know, it's been a while since people kind of said, oh, Ridley Scott, that seems like great news. I mean, it's sort of unfortunate. But The Martian, well, what did you think, Bob?
Oh, I had a great time. I had the advantage of sitting right next to someone who had read the book, who every once in a while nudged me and said things like, well, there's a lot more of that.
Yes.
And there is a lot more, I understand, in the novel than there is of the science.
Right.
Up there. But man, this is an exciting picture and a funny picture. And I wouldn't have thought, I mean, you know, you hear somebody's marooned on Mars, you do not immediately leap to ha 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 ha. And yet you do a lot.
When I talked to people about the fact that this movie was coming up, people who had read the book, a lot of the concern that I heard was, do you think they're going to hang on to kind of the book's sense of humor? Because really, a certain sense of humor about his predicament is one of the ways that this guy survives.
Mm-hmm.
And a certain kind of darkly funny bravado is one of his coping mechanisms. And so I was really happy to see that that survived. I think this, you'll remember that one of the things that I got frustrated about with Gravity was that it loaded the Sandra Bullock character up with all this backstory to make sure that you knew it was important that she live. And my whole argument was, I wish that they had confidence in the fact that just her performance and the fact that you cared about the character would be enough. That's basically what they do with this guy. He has very little backstory. He does not have kids waiting at home. He does not have a wife waiting at home.
Actually, you don't know if he does. That's the thing.
I think because he talks about his parents, I think it's pretty clear that he doesn't, because he does talk about somebody getting in touch with his parents if anything happens to him. But it's enough that he's himself.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Bob and I both really enjoyed.
I had the best time at this picture. I like pictures that you feel immersed in.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I love the way they use 3D in this picture. And I don't ordinarily say that. Mm-hmm. But they use 3D to be dust and particles and at one point screws mm-hmm. flying around. And they're flying around the auditorium. They don't, mm-hmm. you know, it feels like you're there with him. And it's that part is really cool.
Yeah. Not necessarily one that we loved, but another 3D that we saw mm-hmm. was called Everything Will Be Fine. And it's directed by Wim Wenders, mm-hmm. Who decided after making a 3D documentary, I'm always going to do 3D. And this is the first, I believe, narrative feature mm-hmm. that he's done since then with 3D. A lot of 3D, but not for the normal things, not for spaceships or effects or big explosions, for stuff like a smudgy window. Mm-hmm. I think the 3D is probably the most interesting thing about that movie.
It's an okay picture. It was fine. It was nothing yeah. special. It was
It's one of these Aftermath of an Extraordinary Event movies. You know, I don't think it's not my favorite.
That tone of voice was your review.
Yeah.
All right, let's hear about another good one.
Can you talk, Bob, a little bit about the Charlie Kaufman
That
picture?
Is the one I'm dying to hear.
Anomalisa. If you liked Being John Malkovich, he's an amazing writer. He decided he was going to make a picture that was stop motion animated that was made entirely with felt characters. And he was going to make you feel somehow the romance that takes place. And it's a really sort of abortive romance and things aren't going very well. And it's all about the personalities of these felt puppets. And after a little while, I realized how completely involved I'd gotten in it, partly because all of the voices, with the exception of the two main characters, the two characters who fall in love, all the other voices are done by one person. Male, female, children, everybody are done by one person, because the basic premise of this movie is that most people are just dull normal and Lisa is an anomaly, an mm-hmm. anomalisa.
Oh, mm-hmm. interesting.
And so the way that you establish that is by having that voice be different, and it's kind of breathtaking.
Oh,
it's also very clever, and it has things that I don't even think I can talk about them here.
Yeah.
It's perpetually surprising, really an intriguing little movie, and I just thought one of the most gorgeous things of the fest.
Yeah. Yay. Bob and I both also liked a movie called 45 Years.
Oh, yeah.
It's from Andrew, I think it's High, it might be Hay, who did the little film Weekend, mm-hmm. which we've talked mm-hmm. about on this show, which is a very touching.
And was showrunner for the show Looking.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And now he has done this film about an older couple played by these very eminent British actors, Charlotte Rampling and Tom Courtney. It's about kind of a breach in a relationship between people who are older. And it really kind of respects the way that marriages and relationships age over decades, and that they don't, your parents' marriage does not decay into simplicity, which I think is what I think a lot of people kind of picture and assume. And so it's beautiful.
It's gorgeous. And Rampling, Lord.
Yeah, she's
so spectacular in this. And she has a bunch of long, gorgeous scenes where you're reading so much into a flickering change in her eyes or something that's happening in an expression. It's, yeah. it's just, oh, she's great.
Yeah. You want to talk about Son of Saul, Bob, which you really loved?
Well, speaking of immersive, mm-hmm. This is one in which you are immersed in Auschwitz, which is a tough sit. It's called Son of Saul. It's about a guy who you sort of follow through Auschwitz, but always in close-up. You're always very close to his face, to his head. And everything else is slightly out of focus, so that all the atrocities around him are hard to focus on. You can't quite get it. And as a result, A, you feel like you're there because you're focusing on him because you're afraid to look anywhere else, at the same time that what is out there sounds terrifying. You know, it would be wrenching anyway. Holocaust movies are. But this one is much more, I don't know, I don't want to say involving.
Yeah.
It's just like it wraps you inside it and you are stuck there. Now, I saw a couple of pictures that tried to do that. I mean, the Beasts of No Nation, for instance, which is a pretty good movie, tries to immerse you. Idris Elba in a story of child soldiers in Africa. And that one tries to wrap you up in it and does to a certain extent, but doesn't hold you inside the way that this one does. And mm-hmm. Son of Saul is one of the best pictures I've seen in a couple of years.
Yeah. Oh, We saw a bunch of movies in which people play famous people.
Yes.
we saw several of those. There is one called I Saw the Light in which Tom Hiddleston does a surprisingly credible Hank Williams and does not only the acting but also does the singing. And doesn't really sing like Hank Williams, but sings well enough that you can believe he's a singer. Yeah. That's one where I think the performance, I think they want awards consideration for that performance. I think the movie around it is not good enough. I think Bob and I both felt like the movie left us a little bit cold.
Yeah, that wouldn't be the first not very good movie to get acting.
No, it's true. So, I mean, it's true. Mm-hmm. There's also one in which Ethan Hawke plays Chet Baker, which is called Born to be Blue, which is a kind of a weird, disjointed, oddball movie. And I spoke to Bob about the fact that although Ethan Hawke also sings in this movie and at one point sings My Funny Valentine, the funny thing is, although he's very good and it's very emotionally affecting, he does not do as eerie of a Chet Baker playing Chet Baker as Matt Damon did
in
Talented Mr. Ripley when he was doing an eerie Chet Baker. Mm-hmm. But that's a really interesting movie, and Ethan Hawke's really good in it. I saw him in another one with Greta Gerwig called Maggie's Plan, which is a little cute indie for me, but it has, you know, it has a certain Shaggy charm. Julianne Moore is in it in a very not typical Julianne Moore part, I would say. Oh, and one in which Ben Foster plays Lance Armstrong for director Stephen Frears. It's not a spectacular movie, but I actually found it pretty compelling, and I find his Lance Armstrong interesting.
It had to be more interesting than Robert Redford's Dan Rather. It was called Truth, doesn't feel like Truth at any point. It's a sort of a very smug look at the things that got Dan Rather and Mary Mapes fired at CBS. And it's frustrating because there's so much grandstanding. And I have to say, from one angle, there is a profile angle that Redford, you could juxtapose him there'd be no space between him and Dan Rather. But from every other angle, he looks like Robert Redford. And you can't forget that it's Robert Redford playing a part. Yeah. You just can't.
Another one that I want to mention that I really, really liked a lot was Room, which adaptation of the Emma Donoghue novel. She's held captive by this man in a shed. And eventually she gets pregnant and has a son. He's 5 when they begin the movie. She's starting to realize she's going to have to get him out of this situation. Brie Larson, if you saw her in Short Term 12 or any one of a number of other things, is an absolutely spectacular young actress. I kind of love the fact that she went and was Amy Schumer's sister in Trainwreck this summer. I kind of thought that was a cool experiment with a different kind of movie, but she's wonderful. The kid who is the actor is Jacob Tremblay, was 7 or 8 when they shot this and is wonderful in it as well. And I think for people who love that novel, I've only heard readings of part of the novel, but to me it felt true to the voice as much as it can be when you can't really get back the fact that it's a narrator who's a 5-year-old kid. Okay. Glenn, you had some questions about some that you were curious about.
Yeah. Did you guys see The Final Girls, which is a film about contemporary young women who get sucked into an 80s slasher pick with all the knowledge of that genre? They bring to the experience all the knowledge of that genre. It's supposed to be very funny.
I really enjoyed it. I saw it. It stars Tysa Farmiga, I would pronounce it perhaps incorrectly, Malin Ackerman, Nina Dobrev, a bunch of other people. I think the cast is really strong. I think that it's a good cast. And even though that kind of self-aware horror comedy is something that has been done a fair amount with Scream and Cabin in the Woods and stuff like that, I think this is a purer comedy than some of those are. Mm-hmm. It has its blood moments, but it's more of a pure comedy. I really enjoyed it. Thomas Middleditch, who's in Silicon Valley, is in it and is great and funny.
So. Cool. Bob, I think you saw The Lobster, which is the latest
strangest
film,
thing in the world.
directed by Yorgos Lanthimos, who is a Greek director. This is his first English language film. It's his first kind of big film because his previous ones were much smaller. I loved a film he did called Dogtooth. The premise, it's the future. And if you do not hook up with somebody else, if you do not pair up, you are turned into an animal.
Yes.
Right.
You go to a hotel, a grand hotel, and you stay in there for 45 days, and you have 45 days to find a mate. Mm-hmm. And if you don't, you get to be the animal of your choice. And he chooses lobster because he likes seafood. I don't know. Yep. It is so strange. And after a little bit, you realize that they seem to have decided that like goes with like in this society. So the guy with a speech impediment looks for the girl with a stutter, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And so he teams up with a variety of people. I mean, Colin Farrell does, with a variety of people. And you just think, ooh. And as they're getting closer and closer to it being real, at some point you realize that, wait, there's this whole other society out in the woods where they value solitude as much as these people value coupledom, with equally bizarre results. And it's the strangest thing. And anytime you see an animal in this movie, you start to get worried because it's got to be somebody's, you know, sister.
Awesome. Cannot wait.
Really strange.
And finally, the most NPR baity of them all, Lady in the Van, the Alan Bennett film, starring Maggie Smith, about a woman who actually lived in his driveway, basically.
She's a homeless lady. She lives in her van. Maggie Smith is just amazing. I mean, she's terrific. She played this on the West End.
Like 12 years ago, though.
Yeah. And she was reportedly spectacular. It's directed by Nicholas Heitner, who directed her there. And Alan Bennett actually makes a brief appearance. I would like to go on record as thinking that Alan Bennett is one of the great writers in English. Mm-hmm. He did The Madness of King George. He did The History Boys. He worked with Beyond the Fringe team a zillion years ago with Peter Cook and Dudley Moore.
Yeah, and I've talked about Talking Heads, his television series.
Which is gorgeous. Yeah. I mean, he's just an amazing writer. And this is, you expect it to be kind of crotchety and eccentric. It's so much more than that in a really human way, and it just becomes engaging but never saccharine. And, you know, he let her sit in a van in his driveway for 15 years.
Yeah,
in real life, he did this. I mean, it's amazing. So anyway, it's a really interesting thing.
Does it kind of check that Philomena cute old lady kind of box?
No, I mean, that's what it doesn't do, and it's okay. Kind of refreshing.
A couple other ones that I would mention. There's a film called Angry Indian Goddesses, which is a bunch of Indian women talking about their lives, but has underneath all that wonderful kind of chatter a very strong theme of their frustration and anger about violence against women and sexual violence and how they're treated by the police and the government. And it's actually ultimately quite a devastating film in some ways, but it's also a lot of fun for a lot of the way through. It's a really cool and interesting and different. It's one of those things, I said this to Bob, you realize how much movies that you see on a day-to-day basis are like each other.
Yeah.
When you see one that you're like, oh, this is not following any plan or path that I am accustomed to at all. Bob and I both saw a satire mockumentary called No Men Beyond This Point.
This is one that I only saw the first 45 minutes of and that I thought was absolutely hilarious.
Yeah.
And apparently it went a little south.
I felt like it fell apart a little bit. It's about, as I said, a mockumentary about an alternate reality in which women stop giving birth to boys and eventually there's just women left. And they develop the ability to reproduce without men. And so it's just women and girls and baby girls. And it's about this couple of women that has the youngest man on earth, who is like 37, is working for them. And there are no boys anymore. It falls apart a little bit, but I think there will be people who will find its satirical point of view interesting.
All right. So here's what I need to know. And this is one of my, you probably know where I'm going with this based on previous Toronto Film Festival conversations.
Uh-oh.
What is the Oscar bait movie that I will dread having to see in 4 months?
It may not have been there. You know, there's a lot yet to come. It doesn't always happen.
I would have said prior to the festival, I would have told you absolutely it's going to be The Danish Girl. But in general, the Danish girl is Eddie Redmayne playing the
transgender woman.
A transgender woman who undergoes
surgery as part of her transition.
Right.
And this happened in the 1920s, and it's a true story, and Eddie Redmayne is spectacularly good in it. And the whole thing feels upholstered and safe. We are a different society than we were, I feel like, when this picture started being made.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
I see what you're saying.
And the result of that is that it feels so safe and tame and upholstered and pretty.
Yeah.
That it feels like Masterpiece Theater. Yeah. This is one you could take your great aunt to.
So I'm going to have to see it in 4 months.
Well, you might, except it didn't. It wasn't that well received.
And it's interesting because what Bob is saying about the Danish Girl is somewhat true of about Ray, which I saw, which is about a transgender teenage boy, modern day rather than the 20s. But he's played by Elle Fanning, and then his mom is played by Naomi Watts, and then his grandma is Susan Sarandon. And the director managed to say some very boneheaded things about the casting of Elle Fanning and referred to the character as a girl, which is really funny because the movie is unambiguous that the character is a boy, but the director just completely bit it in this interview and now, you know, has come under, deservedly so, a ton of scrutiny. But ultimately, the movie just feels very well-intentioned, very American indie. It's mostly about, I would say it's more about the Naomi Watts character, the mom, than it is really about the son.
And you know, people are making the same statement. I liked a lot Freeheld. There's a movie about a police officer played by Julianne Moore in New Jersey who wants her survivor benefits to go to her lesbian partner. And
Ellen Page, right?
Ellen Page, and they won't allow that to happen. Mm-hmm. And there are people who are saying that it is her work partner, played by Michael Shannon, who becomes the main figure in the in the movie towards the end. So it's not really the story of the lesbians at the film's theoretical center.
Yeah.
There's a lot of talk about how these movies are shifting off of the LGBT axis in order to be accessible to a larger audience, and that's what they're trying to do.
So Bob and I will both take further questions about what we saw in Toronto. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org, or tweet us, of course, at NPRPCHH, where you can always find us. Now, when we come back, we're going to talk about the fall TV season. It is about that time. It's time for our TV pool, which means you get to see me make a lot of bad predictions. It's exciting. So we'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from Bleecker Street, presenting the new film Pawn Sacrifice. In a gripping true story set during the height of the Cold War, American chess prodigy Bobby Fischer, played by Tobey Maguire, finds himself caught between two superpowers when he challenges the Soviet Empire. Also starring Liev Schreiber and Peter Sarsgaard, Pawn Sacrifice chronicles Fischer's terrifying struggles with genius and madness, and the rise and fall of a kid from Brooklyn who captured the imagination of the world, now playing.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before the break, we were talking about upcoming fall movies. Now we're going to talk a little bit about fall television. You may or may not be aware that every year around this time, we try to gather together and do our fall TV pool, which is where we each pick a show, upcoming, new show for fall. We theoretically started off picking a show, saying that the idea was to pick a show that would do well, that would be successful and well-rated and would survive. The objective has shifted over time because I'm terrible at predicting ratings. And so now I just often pick something that I think is going to be good and fun that I'm going to be glad to have watched. Now,
I was gonna say, the metric has shifted for you because you have actually seen a lot of these shows. The metric for me is ratings.
Right. No, that's completely fair because I've seen a bunch of these pilots and these guys haven't. So for the most part, they are going off of kind of the theory of ratings and descriptions, whereas in some cases, I'm going off of having seen the show. Stephen, you want to remind me last year at this time what picks we had?
Usually it's been pretty easy to determine a winner. It's often me.
Right.
I won the first year when I picked Revenge.
Yeah.
I think of myself as having won when I picked Masters of Sex, but you picked Brooklyn Nine-Nine and declared yourself the winner.
Mm-hmm. I think that's fair, though. I mean,
because I'm right, because it's awesome, because now you love it.
I do love Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I'm willing to maybe say that you were number one and I was 1A.
There you go.
But last year,
all I've ever won.
Do I get any points for Transparent?
I mean,
yes.
I suppose. Transparent is obviously, Bob picked Transparent last year. Transparent is largely universally beloved.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn picked The Flash on the CW.
Doing well.
Very successful show. Huh. I picked How to Get Away with Murder. Viola Davis just won an Emmy for lead actress for that show. That is a hit show. Linda, having almost picked Jane the Virgin, which is a hot and wonderful show, ended up picking Blackish, which is a very, very successful and also heavily at least award nominated show.
Also a good show.
I think we all did well. And I think we should each hoist a participation trophy for last year.
Absolutely.
Yeah, fair.
I give myself points for picking Blackish. That seems like a good pick.
Good show.
Steven, what do you have this year for me, buddy?
I'm just going straight for ratings. I'm just going straight for a show that I will almost certainly not watch.
Sure.
But I've decided that it is going to be smashingly successful. The Verge calls it stylish, sour, and needlessly spiteful.
Ah. All right.
Wait, is it our show?
And I saw the headline and was like, I am in. Oh, I can't wait to watch this show. So Scream Queens on Fox.
Ryan Murphy and his Glee collaborators.
Yeah, and also people who made American Horror Story. Mm-hmm. This show purports to combine the two, I would say, is at least a thumbnail sketch of what's going on in this show. It's basically a sorority in an upper crust private college that is a house of murder.
Sprawling cast.
Sprawling, huge
Emma
cast.
Roberts, Jamie Lee Curtis most awesomely, Kiki Palmer, in the first episode, Ariana Grande
is in it, Nick Jonas
is in it, Jonasing it up.
So it's what it seems to be going for is a combination of trashiness and banter, and
yes.
I have watched the trailer. I'm not sure how actually effectively it's doing those things,
right.
But it seems to be getting a big marketing push. Mm-hmm. It is very, very pretty people doing incredibly lurid things. I have a feeling like you look for a show that has the potential to be a social media phenomenon and, get that kind of scandal, empire, big, pulpy, trashy.
Yeah.
Those tend to be the new shows that become hot.
So a couple years ago, part of your ramp up to eventually choosing Masters of Sex, part of the gas baggery that came before that. was how we're going to get away from violence on television
right.
and
violence,
into
yeah.
sex.
Sex up, violence down.
And this show is about stabbing.
Yep.
So yes, it sure is.
I've decided I was wrong.
Okay.
I would say the difficulty with Scream Queens is Ryan Murphy and friends have a tendency to write hateful dialogue and put it in the mouths of pretty women.
Sure.
And they find that a very interesting place to be. There was some of that on Glee, particularly with the Jane Lynch character. There was also some of it on The New Normal, which they did, where Ellen Barkin played a kind of bigoted grandmother.
Right. I gather this show has, The Verge review was very clear that...
It has quite a bit of that. It has too much of it for me, but it also has, at times, a kind of campy tone that I appreciated. So we'll see what people think about that one. All right, Glenn Weldon, what are you picking?
Well, I'm sure you think you know what I'm going to pick.
I know.
I do think I know what you're going to pick.
I got layers. I'm not predictable. I was seriously thinking about Grandfathered, not because I have anything for or against John Stamos, but because I have a huge thing for Paget Brewster.
Yes.
Paget Brewster of the Thrilling Adventure Hour, the late limited Thrilling Adventure Hour, who is fantastic, and this show is smart enough to hire her in a major role that really made me feel favorable toward it. Didn't pick it. Minority Report looks interesting and the guy's hot. The Man on the High Castle is based on a Philip K. Dick story. Legends of Tomorrow, which is the Arrow Flash spinoff, which is kind of has a agreeable cheesiness to it. I was almost picked that, but who the hell am I kidding? Hit me.
Stunned.
Up, up, and away.
There we go. That is, of course, Supergirl, starring Melissa Benoist. And I'm basing this all on the preview. She smiles. She doesn't brood. The city that she's in is sunny. There's no rain. It takes place during the day. There are primary colors to be seen.
All right.
And she just looks so charming and fun. And they are marketing this show very smartly. There's a separate video of her bonding with these like 8-year-old girls, which is such a smart thing to do. It gets that there are superheroes and there are superheroes. Some punish, some protect. So, and that's what she's going for. And there's this whole thing about the heroic ideal. So I picked it. I'm also picking it because I think it's interesting from a business perspective. You know, the Marvel Cinematic Universe is huge. It's got all these things, and they make it so that the television talks to the movies talk to the television shows. When they do it for things like Daredevil, they kind of keep Daredevil off in this one little tiny corner, and it works in that little sort of hermetically sealed thing. They may make passing reference to things in the movies, but it's really about the show. Conversely, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has to navigate these very choppy waters where all these things are happening, and it has to kind of keep reacting to them. and it makes it a lesser show. And those producers have talked about how they keep getting waved off of certain things because one of the 17 directors who are doing another movie are saying, no, that's for us. DC has made it very clear that there are the movies and there are the television shows and they don't have anything to do with each other.
Yeah.
And that is...
And thank goodness in the case of this particular world.
For nerds like me, that whole shared cinematic universe is a lot of fun. I don't think normals care.
I don't think they've crossed it over enough to give it a lot of value as between the TV and the movies.
They keep making references to it, but it's not that it doesn't feel organic. The TV shows look cheaper. That's certainly the case with The Flash. It's certainly the case with Arrow even. They just look cheaper, but there's something goofy about it. I am totally in and out. I should caution that the metric for success of this is tricky because a show could be a hit on the CW and still not get the ratings that would make it survive on CBS. This is a CBS show. A lot more is at stake.
This is why it's good to look at things from a variety of perspectives, because I'm going to tell you right now, I like this pilot a lot. It is exactly what you say. It is fun. It is funny. There are two dudes in it, and I don't actually know which one you're supposed to want her to end up with because they're both lovely. One of them is Jeremy Jordan, who you know how I feel about that guy. I found it really enjoyable. And to be perfectly honest, and I have heard this from more than just me, what it reminded me of was my early, early love of Lois and Clark.
There you go.
Which brought out kind of the romantic comedy aspect or the kind of plucky aspect of superhero stories. That is a piece of high praise coming from
me. Yes, it is. It's very high.
So I really enjoyed that one. I hope people love it because I really like it and I think she's terrific in it. All right, Bob Mondello. And I will say, I gave Bob a little nudge towards something I thought he might enjoy.
And I do. It really looks like fun, but Glenn has already dismissed it as, well, it's the CW. It looks to be a very, very funny romance in the style sort of Glee, but not really.
It's
where
a musical.
She's gonna sing a lot. It's called Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. And she basically decides to follow her non-boyfriend to California and makes a lot of what look like absolutely terrible decisions for the duration. And I fell down the Rachel Bloom rabbit hole. I went on the web and I started looking up all of her music videos, and I adore this woman. I mean, she's very funny. It's getting a different sort of big musical production value than the kind of thing that they did with Glee, which all felt like it was taking place inside somebody's gymnasium.
Right.
And this one looks like it's taking place outside, and it just looks like fun.
It's silly and funny, and this is another one where I sort of regret in some ways the title that they chose, because there were women critics, particularly at press tour in the summer, who reacted with a certain cringe to this phrase, crazy ex-girlfriend, both because you don't want to use the word crazy in a careless kind of way, and because the implication is crazy ex-girlfriend. The show is all being run by women. And what they said was essentially, this is the joke is, she is the crazy ex-girlfriend, but it's kind of about everybody's been that person. Everybody's been the person who doesn't perhaps behave at their most rational when it comes to people that they've had relationships with. It was a panel that I think really built goodwill in the room with the critics for this show, just because the answers were so smart and so funny. And it really, it's one of those things that gives you confidence at the very least that people are really, really trying to make something good and are very committed to it. Because that's what I always say about press tour panels, is that the biggest thing you can tell from a good panel is that something is being made with a lot of love. Yeah. And I think this is being made with a lot of love. So I was very glad that Bob took the suggestion to pick this one.
Yeah, no, this looks like enormous fun. I'm actually going to watch it.
Outstanding. I think you should. So I personally chose The Grinder on Fox, which is a show.
A poorly named,
but it is a show. It's not about Grinder. It is about an actor who used to play a lawyer. And what you will hear in this clip is a kind of meta joke about the fact that Rob Lowe used to be on a TV show about a lawyer named The Grinder. And now you're following him after the end of the show when he is coming to spend time with his brother, who is played by Fred Savage, who has returned to a lovely network show. And I'm so happy about it. So play me the clip, Jess.
After 8 seasons, the Grinder series finale begins now.
Uncle Dean, it's so cool watching you, like, watch the show and stuff.
But that doesn't make him a killer.
He's mouthing the freaking words.
Shh. So that's the family watching together as the show ends. And what happens is Fred Savage plays an actual lawyer who has no kind of stage presence. He does not have the presentation part of lawyering down. And so he teams up with his brother, the fake lawyer. None of it makes any sense, but it's enormous good fun. I'm not going to say that Rob Lowe is playing Chris Traeger of Parks and Rec in this show, but he's not entirely not playing Chris Traeger. And I think it's hitting some of the same notes, as often happens once people figure out that you're good at a certain kind of comedy, they will bring those beats back. And it is so nice to see Fred Savage, who for a long time has mostly been directing, has been off directing comedy and has really made his way that way, come back. And he's still so funny and he's so good in this. And I really, really enjoyed them together. There's something to be said for a really genial, likable, non-acrid kind of network comedy. And I will also mention the one that I almost picked, which is the very silly but surprisingly enjoyable, and I think this could also be your killer hit, is Quantico on ABC, which is a kind of a goofy spy
romantic. That like one of them might be a terrorist?
And it stars a woman named Priyanka Chopra, who for one thing is one of the prettiest women I've ever seen in person. I saw her press tour. I saw her at the ABC party. She is unbelievable. But also she is an enormous Bollywood star. Mm-hmm. I have a belief that this could be a big, it's not a Shondaland show, but it feels like it's a cousin to the Shondaland shows.
You say it's goofy. Is it funny? Is it a comedy?
No.
Or is it just, okay,
no,
so it's over the top.
It's really sort of like, and I said something on Twitter about how I like it because it's not serious, we are a spy show. It's kind of like crazy stuff, twins, woo! And the Quantico writer's room favorited it, which felt a little bit to me like how much they liked it when we did the joke about revenge. I felt like, okay, they have a little bit of a sense of humor, you know. Uh-huh. At any rate, come and find us on Facebook or on Twitter and tell us what you're looking forward to and what you're excited to see. And tell us what you think about all of our picks, and then we'll see who's wrong. Spoiler, probably me. When we come back, it will be time for our very favorite part of the show, what is making us happy this week, so don't go away.
I know you love listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour, so I think you should also check out the first episode of NPR's new Hidden Brain podcast. Shankar Vedantam explores a conversational phenomenon called switch tracking, when two people think they're talking about the same thing, but in reality are speeding down separate tracks. It usually doesn't end well. The Hidden Brain podcast is out now. Subscribe on the NPR One app, iTunes, or npr.org/podcasts, and don't miss an episode.
Well, before the break, we were talking about fall television, and now we are at our favorite part of this week and every week, what is making us happy. So, Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
You know, I've talked recently on this show about my daughter's burgeoning interest in horror. I've been looking for some more kid-friendly gateways into horror, and we watched Coraline. Over the weekend. It is a terrific film. Mm-hmm. I'd managed to, of course, in Thompson fashion, bought the DVD and had never watched it.
Yeah.
I mean, story-wise, the story is by Neil Gaiman. The story is boils down to a fairly familiar kind of evil stepmother type figure. Mm-hmm. But the visual wit, it's so striking to look at, and I watched it on a Blu-ray, which was the right way to see this particular film. So watching the movie Coraline, you know, years after it came out, and really, really dug it.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
Couple things. The Small Press Expo was this past weekend out in North Bethesda, and I managed to get out of the city. This is not my want to go to it. And it's just, you know, it always feels like home. It's a comic book convention, essentially, exposition for indie comics, mini comics, things made with love. And as you're going, the hotel is right across from the metro stop. So as you're going down the escalator, you can kind of see this long line of people, and it's cardigan, bald beardo. Check. And it's like, for the women, it's like Louise Brooks, Betty Page. Just a long line.
Uh-huh.
And it's just so cool. And I picked up so many things. Just walked the floor with Dan Coyce from Slate.
Mm-hmm.
And they must have thought we were either brothers or lovers because we were both a couple of bald beardos. And I picked up a series that I had been meaning to pick up for quite some time called Teen Boat by Dave Roman and John Green, not that John Green. And it's basically about a teenager who can transform himself into a boat. It's an all-ages title. Here is the tagline: the angst of being a teen, the thrill of being a boat. I'm in. I also picked up a really great comic called You Approach a Dark Manor, which is 60 different artists, each taking a different room in a haunted house and just drawing it. That's the book. It's really smart and really fun. A whole bunch of other stuff. And then on the way back into the city, the entire car was reading comics. The entire subway car is reading comics. And it's just like I ventured into this alternate reality, which was much better than this one. On Sunday morning, in the New York Times style section, the front page of the New York Times style section from the September 20th edition, is a profile of the inimitable, because if you tried to imitate her, she would cut you, Grace Jones. It's such a great piece of writing. It's by Michael Shulman, and she exudes in this piece exactly what you want her to, because, you know, being a diva, let me tell you about being a diva. It's not about arrogance. It's really about hauteur, right? Mm-hmm. And hauteur is, it's more passive. It's the air you breathe. Mm-hmm. She's got a book out now called I'll Never Write My Memoirs. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she talks about things like, you know, here's what I did after disco became tacky. And you're like, was disco ever not tacky? And we find out that in her writer, she must have in her green room 2 dozen oysters on ice, unopened, because, quote, Grace does her own shucking, unquote. And at one point, the hotel employee, some hapless poor hotel employee, comes in and says they have to clear the room. And she says to her, you're so corporate. I would hate having your job. Do you want to work for me? Now that's where the fantasy epic starts, right? That is Joseph Campbell. That is the call to adventure right there. I want to write that story. But no, she refused the call. Mm-hmm. But it's just so fun, and I loved it. So it's called The Power of Grace in the Sunday, September 20th, New York Times.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Bob Mondello, what is making you happy this week?
Well, you know that Stephen Sondheim always makes me happy,
oh, sure,
right? I mean, but there is a new selection that is apparently making Stephen Sondheim happy.
Oh, nice.
It is called Liaisons, Reimagining Sondheim from the Piano.
Oh.
And basically what he allowed is for a bunch of other composers, and these guys have a collection of like 35 Oscars and Grammys and things like that. He allowed other composers to reinvent his music. And so they've played with it. And here's one. It's basically Joanna from Sweeney Todd, Joanna from the Stars. What is nice about this is that you hear these songs as if you have not heard them 1,000 times, and I have heard them 7,000 times.
Yeah.
So for me, this is like heaven. This is, I get to rediscover these melodies. I remember my father being excited about Bobby Darin doing something that he remembered from before. This feels like that. This is like
wonderful.
Very exciting.
Thank you very much, Bob Mondello. Well, before I talk about what is making me happy, I do want to tell people that our next episode after this one, we are going to talk about the comic Ms. Marvel. So if you're interested in reading along with us, grab yourself some issues of Ms. Marvel, and we'll be talking about that in next week's show. The other thing making me happy this week is the return of The Mindy Project.
Oh, yeah.
Which is back on Hulu and has come back for its fourth season. And they do not do at Hulu the full season dump of episodes.
Right, they don't.
They are putting out one at a time, as nature intended. So there is, as of this taping, there is one episode out. And I have been saving it for myself. And so I watched it right before we came into tape. And I'm actually only about 2/3 through it. And I'm very much looking forward to it. I'm kind of dripping it in little bits to myself because I only get one for a week. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's delightful. The premiere features Joseph Gordon-Levitt as Mindy's husband in an alternate universe, which turns out to be much funnier and more interesting than your typical kind of fantasy setup like that. I became a big fan of this show by the time it left Fox. I'm a big fan of what she's tried to do with a lot of the characters on that show. I'm a big fan of what she's tried to do with the romantic comedy elements of that show. So I'm very excited about seeing that show back and very, very pleased. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at IDislikeStephen and Glenn at GHWeldon. And you can follow Bob Mondello at Bob_Mondello. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.